The following program is a production of St. Peter the Rock Media and is brought to you by you. If you like it, consider making a donation and supporting Catholic radio programming on AM 1260 The Rock. Click on the Donate Now button in the upper right corner of our webpage.
Dr. David Anders shares in his book, The Catholic Search Saved My Marriage, how he and his wife came to know and fully embrace the Catholic Church. Dr. Anders is a Catholic catechist, speaker, and writer living in Birmingham, Alabama. He hosts the EWTN radio program called Call to Communion. He grew up in the Presbyterian Church and attended a Protestant college and seminary. During his PhD studies in Reformation history, he became persuaded of the truth of the Catholic faith. He entered the church in 2003 with his wife, Jill, and now five children. You can find out more about Dr. Anders at Calvin to Catholic. That's Calvin, the number two, Catholic.com. And with no further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. David Anders.
All right. Is my mic working? Can you all hear me? Is that fine? All right. I'm going to set my timer so I don't talk too much, which is something I tend to do. So I'm very happy to be here. And Bernadette, I ran into her last year at the EWTN radio conference in Birmingham, Alabama, and she said, I'd love to have you come up to Ohio, and I'd really like to do something for the young adults. And I'm thrilled to see a room absolutely filled with young adults this morning. And so I prepared this discussion really oriented towards that the particular generation that's you know coming into adulthood now, those born after 1995, what we call Generation Z, or some people call the I generation. You know, you have iPhones, you have iPads, now we have iGen, right? Those that grew up with the internet in their pockets. And so looks like actually many of you, like me, did not grow up in that generation, but you have children and maybe grandchildren that did. And maybe you're sensitive to some of the chaos and wreckage that they're experiencing in their lives and their generation. That's not wholly different from what we experienced growing up, but it's just dialed up a notch, quite a few notches, in fact. And a lot of them are leaving the faith. Actually, most of them are. And we're struggling as their parents and grandparents to know what to do about it. So that's really the target audience for the talk, but hopefully it'll be applicable for you as well. I want to share with you something rather somber. I'm going to read a suicide note. All right? This suicide note is from a woman named Tara Condell, and she was a 27-year-old nutritionist who, in the state of New York last year, last January, hung herself. And the reason we know this suicide note is that she posted about it online. She wrote it in her blog before she died, and this is what she says. I've written this note several times in my head for over a decade. This one finally feels right. No edits, no overthinking. I have accepted that hope is nothing more than delayed disappointment. And I am just plain old-fashioned tired, feeling tired. I realize that I am undeserving of thinking this way because I truly have a great life on paper. I'm fortunate to eat meals that most only imagine. I often travel freely without restriction. I live alone in the second greatest American city, San Francisco. You'll always have my heart. However, all these facets seem trivial to me. It's the ultimate first world problem. I get it. I often felt detached while in a room full of my favorite people. I also felt absolutely nothing during what should have been the happiest and darkest times of my life. No single conversation or situation has led me to make this decision. So at what point do you metaphorically pull the trigger? I'm going to miss doing New York Times crossword puzzles. I'm going to miss the charcuterie board with Taleggio in Judah. Anything Szechuan, mala, that goes without saying. A perfect plate of carbonara. Real, true, authentic street tacos. Cal Italian cuisine. Hunan's Bistro, fried rice. The pork belly and great mini from State Bird Provisions circa 2013. Popeyes, of course, and Bamba's too. I'm going to miss unexpected hugs. Al Green's Simply Beautiful, Cherries in July, Tracing a Sleeping Eyebrow, Smoking Cigarettes, the Golden Gate Bridge at Sunset, the first sip of ice-cold brew in sticky August, making eye contact with people walking down the street, when songs feel like they're speaking to your soul, Jeopardy, saying I love you, late-night junk food binges, and especially the no-destination insight long walks. No GoFundMes, no funerals, no tributes, no doing too much, please. All I ask now is that you have one delicious, and I mean really great, meal in my honor, and let me go, no exceptions. It is selfishly time for me to be happy, and I know you can get down with that. Please try to remember me as a whole human being you shared memories with, and not just my final act. This is not your fault. It's not exactly easy for me either. I'm here for you. I love you. I always have and always will. I promise. Shakata Ganai. I'm coming home, Dad. Make some room on that cloud and turn up the Motown. I'm really sorry, Mom. End of note. So, to me, the most striking thing about Condell's suicide note is that she put it on the internet. What can it possibly mean that when she determines once and for all to separate herself from everything and everyone, that she announces this decision to an anonymous amalgam known as cyberspace? By her own admission, she lost or never had the ability to connect meaningfully with people face to face. But her desire for connectivity was writ large across her decision to sever all connections. There are several other things worth noting in this poor woman's final thoughts. She enumerates many good things that she enjoyed throughout her life, especially the variety of cultural options available to her, primarily food, travel, and spontaneous society. This litany of pleasures evidences a practical naturalism. We find no indication that Condell sees behind or beneath the material things of this world any sort of transcendent ground. It's not surprising, therefore, that she remarks on the triviality of being and the illusory nature of hope. Condell is almost cavalier in her rejection of ritual. This is simply what she calls doing too much. Ritual, by definition, is a socially transmitted pattern of behavior meant to draw us out of ourselves and into some shared meaningful experience, some common good, from the fairly pedestrian like a football game or a concert to something profound like the Mass. But for Condell, there are no common goods of this sort that don't collapse into doing too much. When there's no hope and there's no transcendent, then it stands to reason that the good is simply what seems good to me. In Condell's final social withdrawal and the abandonment of her family, she justifies in the interests of her own subjective happiness, a position she takes to be self-evident. I know you can get down with that, she says. Relationships in her world are adventitious. Their significance, as far as we can tell, consists in surprising occasions for spontaneous pleasure. They don't mean anything beyond themselves. Neither romance nor commitment appear even worthy of refutation. And finally, her death itself does not reverse her judgment on value or meaning. It marks either a passage into oblivion or a continuation of the valueless sense pleasure by which she characterized her own life. There is no hint that death might mark a transcendent horizon across which all our seemingly trivial actions might take on an eternal significance. Is Tara Condell an anomaly? I wish I could say so. But there's a significant body of data that suggests that Condell's attitude towards life is more and more common. Obviously, not everyone will respond to the sentiments that she had the way she did. Nevertheless, her subjectivism, her relativism, her naturalism, her hopelessness, and her isolation, those things that characterized her attitude, seem to be widespread and growing in this generation. The malaise is not unrelated to the ubiquitous presence of the internet and to social media in our lives. There's a social psychologist named Jean Twenge. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Who's written a book on this generation, the so-called I generation, those born after 1995. I don't suppose anybody in this room was born after 1995, was it? I didn't think so, right? But my oldest child was born in 1995, so all of my kids fit into this category. iGen, the title of the book is iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. According to Twenge, the big cultural shift happened in 2012. Social psychologist studies demographic change over time. She says, generally speaking, you can mark passage of demographic change in attitudes and behaviors over time. It's generally kind of a gentle slope, all right? But looking at the data, 2012 looks like this. It's just a sharp jerk upwards, the most abrupt change in social behaviors and expectations that she had seen in 100 years worth of data. What happened in 2012 that might mark that abrupt change? Not the internet, that started in 95. The iPhone, the internet in your pockets, all right? And the way we began to relate to ourselves and to one another through that technology, that marked the change in 2012. She identifies 10 traits that strongly differentiate this generation from previous generations in American history. First of all, they are not in a hurry to grow up. They're not in a hurry to grow up. They go to work later. They finish school later. They marry later, if they marry at all. They have children later. The number of young men who are, you know, upstairs in the attic and still cannot leave off the video games at age 25 or 30 or 35 is epidemic. Most conspicuously, their use of the internet. Most of them check their phones or the internet at least 80 times a day and spend 5 hours a day online. By and large, they don't prefer in-person interaction anymore, but prefer to relate through the internet, through social media. And you've all seen this when you go to the restaurant, right? You walk in, and the entire family is at the table, and what are they all doing? Right? They might actually email to text each other during dinner, right? You know. They are insecure. As a mental health crisis, rates of suicide, depression, and anxiety in this generation are markedly higher than previous generations, especially among girls. Especially among girls. They are irreligious, by and large. Insulated, less involved in community or civic activities. Insecure about their incomes. As the parent of three young adults, I can tell you with a certainty that's true. They're indefinite in their commitments on sex, marriage, children, inclusive in their ideology towards, say, non-standard sexual expressions and gender identity, and independent politically, less likely to be identified with any or either political party. Now, I want to reflect a little bit about why I think this is the case and what the Catholic faith might have to say about it. And I want to tell you, first of all, that I love the internet. I grew up without the internet. I went to graduate school without the internet. This morning, I woke up. Let's see, what did I read on the internet? I read an article on St. Augustine's attitudes about liturgy. I read another article about the taxonomy of Tasmanian devils. And a blog post by an autistic priest, Father Matthew Schneider. And on any given day, I might watch a video on how to play in the Mixolydian mode, watch the Tokyo Symphony play a piece by Beethoven, read an encyclopedia article, or check the news. I mean, I find as much benefit from the variety of cultural forms and information online as anyone. But it seems to me one thing that characterizes the use of the internet is that it never before in human history have so many cultural forms been available so quickly at the drop of a hat and the ability to shift from one to another rapidly without thought or reflection. The meme, if you know what a meme is, right? The advent of the meme sampling cultural forms without criterion or context, and then shifting them widely across that internet space. And at times, even the sacred itself is assimilated into what is basically a uniform commercial and entertainment culture that's deprived of true sacrality. Let me illustrate what I mean by that. In a traditional society, if you lived in, say, you know, pagan or animistic Native American religion or African traditional African religion, you know, your grandfather got up in the morning and really did pour out a libation of banana beer onto the roots of the sacred tree where the ancestors dwelled, because that's where he thought they dwelled. I mean, it was a superstitious belief, and nevertheless, it was a common cultural expectation that unified the entire community around a certain idea of the sacred. The best illustration of this I ever read was in Mircea Eliade's book on the sacred and profane, about the Aboriginal tribe that carried a pole with them wherever they went, the Axis Mundi, the center of the world, the purpose of which was to hold up the sky. And then one day the pole broke. They all lay down on the ground and waited to die. All right. But they really did have a conception of some token, some form, that grounded themselves in a relationship to the transcendent. Now, that sacred tree, Disney now samples it and puts Grandma Willow in Pocahontas, the movie. Right. So rather than being a sort of ground of the transcendent in a culture or in a life, it just becomes a meme to be sampled and rehashed and commercialized for entertainment value. In the Vedic tradition of ancient Hinduism, there's a famous mantra called the Gayatri Mantra. It's now the theme song for the television show Battlestar Galactica. Right, you see the illustration, the point I'm making? Wrenching cultural forms out of their historical, cultural, or sacred context and just commercializing them. All right, and so what do we actually have in common by way of the sacred, by way of a common culture or a literature or a system of values? Well, nothing other than the medium of commerce and exchange itself. So one of the most, I get to travel a lot in my work with EWTN and Catholic Radio, travel all over the country. And one of the things that I find that is consistently the same wherever I go, the Starbucks looks exactly alike in every city. All right, the Whole Foods looks exactly alike in every city. Target doesn't change from city to city. Right, the people change. Languages, religions, values, you know, clothing, food, but the commercial uniform internet culture, right, is one thing that we have in common. Now, the technology also, not only does it sort of relativize this variety of cultural form that's available to us, but it actually affects the way we pay attention to them. There's a researcher named Nicholas Carr who wrote a book a few years ago called The Shallows, about what the internet is doing to our brains. And we think that we are in control of our internet usage, and to a certain extent we are. What we don't understand is the extent to which the gatekeepers of the internet are heavily invested in controlling the way we use the medium. Did you know that Google will test a shade of up to 50 different shades of blue to determine the one that will generate the most click-throughs? Because the way in which the purveyors of internet commerce make money is by our rapid activity going from one site to another. And they generate the look, the feel, the sound in order to generate as much random activity as possible. And if you've spent any time online, you know the temptation, right? You know, I'm getting a little bit older these days. I got the bifocal lenses. It's harder for me to read print text. It's easy for me to read on the iPad because I can blow the thing up. And I'm so keenly aware that in comparison to 20 years ago, when I hold that electronic volume in my hand, oh, that's an unfamiliar word. I could look that up. Oh, well, that makes me think of this other thing. And before long, you've read 10% of three different articles instead of giving yourself in sustained attention to one more, you know, profound and sober work. Ever had this experience? You know what I'm talking about? All right. And it does. This affects the way we relate to information and to culture. And so what we find is that outside of our, maybe the confines of our Catholic faith or our political party, we have less and less of value to talk about with our friends and neighbors. I have a brother who's I love very much, but he left the faith years and years and years ago, about the only thing we can talk about is popular culture. the latest Marvel movie or an episode of Doctor Who. Right? Now, this capacity for sort of radical libertarian choice, I can select one cultural form and another, and I can blend them together and create my own meme, is really sort of the ideal expression of a doctrine that has become baked into our culture, that the ultimate value is just simply my own autonomous choice. Now, right at the beginning of the internet era, 1992, you all know the case, I'm sure, Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote a decision. And he said, it's a celebrated quote from Kennedy, he says, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and the mystery of human life." Right? That reality itself cannot impose a normative structure on me. It is an offense to my own freedom. Pope John Paul wrote against this in Evangelium Vitae when he said, "A freedom that would lead to the culture of death when people realize that life itself could be seen as an imposition on my freedom." Best illustration of this I ever saw was a headline: "Man sues parents for having him without his consent." Now, could this attitude fail to have an effect on our most intimate and profound engagements, namely love, sexuality, how we think about our own death? There's a Catholic sociologist named Mark Regnerus who wrote a book recently called Cheap Sex, to answer that question. And he says the technology today has radically affected the way this younger generation thinks about sexuality, marriage, and relationships. Three technologies in particular. One of them, getting old now, not so new, which is birth control pills, but also online pornography and online dating have drastically lowered the cost of commitment. Excuse me, they've lowered the cost in commitment, right, for sexual and romantic coupling. And human sexual relationships are always a kind of exchange of value. I mean, you think about the troubadour in the Middle Ages who would pledge his troth to the fine lady at the top of the tower and go off and slay dragons and win, you know, defeat armies in order to win her affections. Now he just has Tinder. He can just flip and find someone that'll take less of a commitment out of him, right? And so here's what it has led to. The rise of what Regnerus calls the pure relationship as the ideal, where a social relation is entered into for its own sake, for what can be derived by each person from a sustained association with another, and which is continued only insofar as it is thought by both parties to deliver enough satisfaction for each individual to stay within it. In other words, it's deprived of any sort of transcendent meaning. Now, is there a sense in the culture that maybe all is not well? Maybe all is not well. All right, beyond the rising suicide rates and the anxiety and the depression. Well, there's a symptom that I'd like to mention that I think you've probably all seen. Do y'all have Whole Foods up here? All right, anybody go to Whole Foods ever? I mean, I do. All right. What do you see in the checkout line? What's on the magazine covers? Always, without, apart from the articles on keto, which doesn't work, by the way. All right. How many of y'all have seen the woman in yoga pants, right, sitting on the mat with a fern and an avocado and an article on mindfulness? Right? You know what I'm talking about? It's ubiquitous. Everywhere you look, go to the psychologist's office, flip on the television, walk through the grocery store, and we're being bombarded by marketing, by advertising, by propaganda, telling us that we need to palliate our anxiety and assuage our depression through a very sort of watered-down technique of Eastern meditation called mindfulness. And it's presented as a non-dogmatic practice of therapeutic self-care focused on stress relief, managing anxiety, and finding efficient ways of realizing what you want. I pulled this off of a podcast recently promoting mindfulness meditation. It says, "Find here meditations on sleep, stress, anxiety, happiness, motivation, confidence, designed to inspire and to solve challenges in life and so that you can be your best self. Now, what's interesting to me about this movement, and I really think it's everywhere, it really is everywhere, it's become a cultural meme, it's become a cultural form that we have to engage with, right, as Catholics. And I get questions about it on the radio fairly frequently, probably once a month somebody calls up and says, can I do this thing? What does the church have to say about it? What's most interesting to me, and I've studied the thing in quite a bit of depth, is how, like everything else in the internet culture, this is one cultural form that's been wrenched out of one context and placed in another. If you actually go back and study the history of this Buddhist meditation technique, it's actually grounded in a rather profound, although I believe erroneous, conception of the human person and in a very very deep, committed, ethical life of abstinence and good works. And when I'm talking abstinence, like total sexual continence, vows of poverty and so forth, the religious state. And it's been taken out of that context, made to serve the ends of sort of palliative self-care. Another indication maybe that all is not well. Last night, actually, I looked up a list of the top grossing films of the 21st century. Top grossing films of the 21st century. What do you think they all had in common? Well, yeah, CGI, yeah. Thematically, though. Almost all of them were superhero movies. Almost all of them superhero movies or fantasy. Either they were either Star Wars movies or they were Marvel superhero movies, and then The Lord of the Rings. All right, that was all of them. That was all of them. All right. Now, why is that significant? Well, what do all those stories have in common? Well, all of them are origin stories. Origin stories that tell the hero's journey. Right, the mentor, the call, the journey, the boon, and the return. Right, the desire to immerse oneself in a story, in a narrative, in a tradition of transcendent meaning. Right, Luke's iconic line: "I want to come with you to Alderaan. There's nothing for me here now. I want to learn the ways of the Force and become a Jedi like my father." You know, when I was a child. Of course, I was born before the internet generation, but some of these trends were already beginning to happen. I mean, television, of course, was already a very big thing. I began to study karate, the martial arts, when I was about 10 years old. And it wasn't the athleticism or the physical combat that appealed to me so much. It was the sense of entering into some ancient tradition and to forms that had this august and noble history. And a Japanese sensei who ran around with a bamboo stick and yelled and beat on us and made us feel like we were entering into something noble and transcendent, right? That was what we wanted. We wanted that mentor figure, the Yoda on your shoulder, the Obi-Wan Kenobi, who could initiate you into the secret mysteries. Now, by way of contrast, I want to tell you about a friend of mine, Father Lambert Greenan, who died last year at the age of 101. So Father Lambert was born in 1917 in Newry, Ireland. And in the home he grew up in, the most constant activity was their daily visits to the Dominican church in Newry. And the people in his life whom he admired most were those Dominican priests. And it structured his entire day. He told me frequently that his father would take the children to Mass every day. He took them to confession every week. Dad would go in first, and then in order of age, the sons would go in. He said they prayed the rosary every night as a family on their knees around the dinner table, and it didn't matter if Protestants were with them, if atheists were with them, or if the roast was getting cold, they were going to finish their rosary. The rhythm of the transcendent and the Catholic faith, and specifically Dominican spirituality, governed everything in their life. That idea of the sacred grounding not only their home but their community. Not surprisingly, when Lambert was 7 years old, he told his parents, "When I grow up, I'm going to be a Dominican priest. I'm going to say my first Mass on that altar wearing those vestments." And that is exactly what he did. He entered the order when he was 16 years old. And of course, in those days, all they studied was St. Thomas, morning, noon, and night, in Latin, of course. He was responsible to know the contents of the entire Summa Theologica and had to answer oral exams in Latin. All right, went on to earn his degree in canon law, became a professor, later a prior, and was eventually called to Rome in 1968 to be the editor of L'Osservatore Romano under Paul VI, where he valiantly and courageously fought dragons, right? The American bishops that opposed the church's teaching on Humana Vitae. And he made that the hill he would die on to defend the church's teaching. Lambert was named, of course, for the patron saint of marital fidelity. And then in 1990, Mother Angelica brought him to Birmingham to present some programming. He ended up actually staying, and he became the Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Yoda on the shoulder, the mentor figure initiating us into a time long gone, right? Almost a galaxy far, far away. The Latinate Dominican culture of Newry, Ireland. And I was privileged to count him as my own mentor, right, until the end of my days. Think about how the Catholic faith had grounded him. And he was the most brilliant man, great theological mind that I ever knew, but Dominican through and through. If you know something about Catholic religious history, you'll get tickled by this. I asked him one time, I said, Father Lambert, did you ever read Ignatius's Spiritual Exercises? You know, great classic of Catholic spirituality written by a Jesuit. He said, no. So what did you guys do on retreat then? He said, read St. Thomas, of course. Someone once accused him of being a Jesuit. He said, we taught the Jesuits. So, apart from tradition, there is no way to have a notion of transcendent value, a story to which we can give ourselves. There's nothing worth contemplating if there's nothing ultimately meaningful. What I'd like to suggest to you today is that the I generation, those born after 1995, lack these two things absolutely essential for human flourishing and happiness. So on the one hand, they've been deprived of a deep and meaningful relationship to their own past. You know, I went with my daughter a couple years ago to Mount Rushmore, and we got to hear the tape, watch the movie about the history of the place. And it sounded, you could almost hear the fire crackle sound of the 45 running. I mean, it had this sort of grainy, sort of 30 years ago type aura to it. And the voice of the announcer had a sort of yesteryear quality to it. But what really struck me was the patriotism and the sense of groundedness in history and the American identity. Not that that's necessarily, that nationalism is necessarily the story we should always tell, but it struck me. I would never hear that today from any source. Like the sense of being communally grounded in a value and a history is utterly gone. In fact, rather we throw any tradition under the bus. They've been deprived of their own past, their own ancestors, to a tradition in light of which a life might assume a transcendent direction, in light of which our deepest and most intimate longings, whether for love or for relationship, meaningful relationships to the finality of our own life become intelligible. I'm not just talking about any tradition or every tradition. I mean a common store of values shared across a community and handed down as normative. Without that tradition, without any objective meaning or goal, the I generation has also been deprived of any meaningful focus for contemplation. Instead of the contemplative life that we're all suited for, we pass moment by moment to distractions, unable to attend to or be deeply affected by anything of value. And I'd like to suggest that the Catholic faith is the solution, the antidote to this deracinated and ultimately valueless life. Now, I'll tell you another story about a man I met, an archbishop from Owerri, Nigeria, Archbishop Anthony Obinna. Archbishop Obinna grew up in a culture that had only recently been converted from paganism. Like Cardinal Serra, the prefect for the Congregation of Divine Worship, his was a community where the grandfathers really still were pouring out libations on the sacred trees, right? But the spirit and fathers from France had brought them to the Catholic faith, and he had accepted it enthusiastically. And departed from his tribalistic and polytheistic culture. One of the things that he left behind was the racism of intertribal warfare. Right? Then, of course, he came to the United States in 1982 to pursue master's degree and PhD at Catholic University of America, where he promptly lost his faith because of the nihilism and the secularism and the critical thought of Western culture. And when he went back to Africa, emptied out of meaning and of value, and he began to explore a little bit the roots of the paganism of his ancestors and found what you may or may not know, that in traditional West African religion, there's a profound doctrine of the unity and the eternity of the Creator God. And his knowability, although his transcendence, and our ability to know him and to placate him with offering and sacrifice. And actually, through the natural wisdom of traditional religion, he found his way back into the dynamics of the Catholic faith. And very much like the story of Cardinal Sarah, not only back to a Catholic faith, but a deep appreciation both of what there was of value, but also what needed to be corrected in that superstitious paganism. In particular, the inequities built into a caste-based society of racial superiority and submission versus the Catholic view that every human being was created in the likeness and image of God. The reason I start with Archbishop Urbina's story and Cardinal Sarah is to point out that the Catholic message is not one that is uniquely Western, right, but speaks to deep, universal human need. Christopher Hitchens is one of these cynical, nihilistic atheists that used to throw out the challenge in public debate, what good can a believer do that an unbeliever can't do? And of course, he had in mind only those sorts of goods, material goods, like building schools or hospitals. And I've always thought the best answer to Hitchens' challenge was the life of Josephine Bakhita, another African, this one from the Sudan, who in the 19th century, as I'm sure you know the story, was captured and sold into slavery, treated horribly, never even knew her own name until she was redeemed by an Italian diplomat, taught the Catholic faith, and converted. And she ended her days as a contemplative nun in Rome. And she said this about her life. She said, "I am definitively loved. And whatever happens to me, I am awaited by that love. And so my life is good. If I met those who kidnapped me and even those who tortured me, I would kneel and kiss their hands. For if these things had not happened, I would not have been a Christian and a religious today." You see, the one thing the Catholic faith could give that a Christopher Hitchens could never give is that notion of transcendent hope. She could pass the verdict on her own life of suffering that it was good, whereas a Christopher Hitchens could only have said of her that it was a deluded state. Right? So what is this Catholicism? What is this Catholicism that grounds us in this notion of transcendent value that's applicable whether you're a Westerner or an African or from East Asia? You know, I got that call on the radio one time. A fellow called me up and he said, "You're always going on about this thing called the Catholic Church. What is this thing called the Catholic Church? What is this thing called Catholicism you're talking about?" I was a bit dumbfounded. I thought it was kind of sort of as obvious as the nose on your face that there's a thing called Catholicism in the world, but the guy didn't know. How do you answer that? You got a completely blank slate. Where do you start? Right? So I said something like this. I said, in the book of Genesis, there's a man named Abraham who's called by God to a rejection of the technological, technocratic culture of the men of Babel who tried to make a name for themselves through the work of their hands and to find his value in hearing and obeying the word of God. And he's given a promise that through his descendants, all nations will be blessed. And of course, those descendants grow and become more numerous, and they receive the law from Moses, right, to guide and shape their moral lives. Yet they lack that capacity to do so. And so the prophets promise that a time will come when God will pour out his spirit on all flesh and write the law in their hearts and place it on their minds. And then this will be effected in conjunction with the coming of a kingdom that will never pass away, a king unlike those of the world who does not conquer with sword and horse, but conquers in human hearts by laying down his own life in sacrifice to gather not only Jews but Gentiles as well into the family of God, transforming them, restoring in them the likeness and image of Christ through his holy death and resurrection. This Savior founds an institution, a society, a church spread throughout the entire world to preach this value, these truths, and this promise that we might know God and be loved by him and be awaited by him in love. And come to imitate him and recover his likeness. And the evidence of the proof of this doctrine can be found in the holiness of the saints, right, down through the ages, and in the radical transformation of society that we have witnessed. You know, all the institutions of cultural value that we tend to appreciate, whether universities or the scientific revolution, sound laws of jurisprudence, so the human rights movement, or hospitals and other institutions of benevolence, are fruit of the Catholic doctrine spread throughout the world, right? And did not exist prior to Catholicism, either in the ancient past or in the modern present in those cultures untouched by Catholic influence. That's what I told him. Summarizing the tributaries and the values of this, Colonel Francis George writes, "The Catholic intellectual tradition was not afraid to absorb the cultures of Egypt and Mesopotamia, Greece and Rome, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution, and in more modern times, insight from the East or from the vast diversity of the African continent. The Catholic intellectual tradition is universal in scope, synthetic in purpose. It aims to show the unity of reason in its ceaselessly self-critical stance, and it proposes to unite in faith and reason and mutual complementarity. Briefly put, there's nothing quite like it. Catholicism offers a transnational society, a culture committed to the truth and to the good, to the transformation of the human family in love and in justice. The Church in Christ is like a sacrament or a sign, an instrument, both of a very closely knit union with God and the unity of the whole human race," to quote Lumen Gentium. The I generation needs to connect to this story, all right? It's not just the story of some moribund, archaic and antique civilization. It's their own story, right? Because even the value of freedom that they uphold was given to them by the Catholic Church, but like everything else in this generation, wrenched from its proper context. Freedom is a Catholic value. You know who invented philosophically the doctrine of free will? St. Augustine of Hippo, right? To interpret philosophically the significance of the call to moral action that lay at the heart of the Catholic vision of the human person, that we all have the capacity to enter into relationship to God. That only becomes intelligible in light of the doctrine of the Imago Dei. We're made in His image and likeness. We have the gift of reason. We have the gift of freedom. Freedom for the good. Freedom so that we can deliberate and choose truly, transcendently good, worthy of contemplation. That's the gift of the Catholic faith to all civilization. Before that, do you think Aristotle cared if kids were free to surf the internet? Not at all. He believed some people were born natural slaves. They need to enter into the story, right? And quite frankly, they need to be freed from the lie that happiness is to be found in slavery to their own sexual passion, right? And that, of course, was one of the things that ultimately converted St. Augustine, the recognition that he was not free, right, when he lived in obedience to his own lusts. You know his prayer, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet," right? And never before, I think, in history have we needed so badly the witness of holy continent Catholic religious, like my friend Father Lambert, right? And they're hungry for it. You know, I have one of my close friends is Father John Paul Zeller. You've seen him say Mass on EWTN, right? When he was Brother John Paul, he once went and visited a Baptist university in Alabama with Father Benedict Groeschel. And what interested him the most was the number of young Baptist kids coming out of the woodwork, not to see Father Groeschel, but to talk to this young guy who would don a brown robe like Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? And give himself to a life of poverty and continence. They were fascinated. They were fascinated, right? There's a hunger for this in the heart of man. And the Catholic faith offers a witness to that value that the young people desperately need. Now, contemplation. We're made for contemplation. If you don't think we're made for contemplation, what do you think the iPhone is all about? Why is it that nobody can put the darn thing down, right? Why do you go to the restaurant and all they want to do is stare and look, right? No one wants to sit with an utterly empty mind, right? I have a close friend who is not a believer. We were talking about old age and senescence and paralysis and the things that can come onto you. And his response to me was, "Well, I think as long as I had television, I'd be okay. As long as I had television, I'd be okay." Those of you that have visited nursing homes know that the television never goes off. And it is the saddest thing you have ever seen in your entire life. But it's that hunger for connectedness and for the desire to give ourselves and our attention to something, right? St. Josephine Baquita spoke to that when she tells us before she'd ever heard the Catholic faith, she would go out and see the sun, moon, and stars, and she would tell herself, "Who made these beautiful things?" And she was filled, she says, with a desire to know Him and to pay Him homage. We're made for contemplation. You know the passage in Luke chapter 10. classic text of Catholic contemplative spirituality. Martha was distracted. Right? The essence of the internet generation is distraction. She was distracted by the preparations to be made. Martha, Martha, the Lord answered, you're worried and upset by many things, but few things are needed or only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. You know, many Catholics are led out of the church by a kind of cheap trick, right? When the fundamentalist evangelist approaches them and says, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus? Now, I don't know what it's like in Cleveland. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, where Catholics are 2 or 3% of the population. Ex-Catholics are probably a much higher percentage of the population. I know, because they all went to my church, right? And we would often ask people, did you grow up Christian? And they would say, oh, no, I grew up Catholic. Right? Well, what happened? And they would say, well, you know, I didn't have a relationship with Christ. I didn't have a relationship with Jesus. I didn't know the Bible. And I came to this church and I learned the thing. Right? I myself used that ploy on unwary, naive Catholics who I persuaded to leave the Catholic Church in my own naivete. Right? And I don't want to diminish the spirituality of Protestants who do have a profound relationship with God. But I will tell you that oftentimes it is not as profound as they let on. And might be reduced to something like James Stewart's relationship with Harvey the Invisible Rabbit. Right? Jesus is my invisible friend that I take with me everywhere, and he tells me what flavor hamburger to buy. Right? Not the sort of profound, transformative relationship in the interior life where we imitate Christ, obey his example, and recapitulate his paschal mystery in our own lives through the sacraments to which Catholics are called. I know this because I was over there, and now I'm here, and I can tell you objectively what the difference is between the traditions. But this is traditionally the end of the Catholic life, right? It's contemplative union with God, first in this life and ultimately in the life to come. It comes in different forms, right? According to the personality of the person doing the contemplation. To talk just a little bit about my friend Father Lambert, who was a Dominican through and through, he lost his eyesight. He lost his eyesight, had macular degeneration. He spent the last 10 years of his life when he wasn't talking to me. He sat in his chair at Casa Maria Convent and Retreat House. And I would go see him, and I said, what you been doing, Father Lambert? He would say, he could see a little bit of light, right? He couldn't see well enough to even know that I had a beard. I had a beard for 2 or 3 years before he knew about it. And one day I mentioned something about my beard, and he said, you have a beard? I said, yes, Father. He said, shave it off. It makes you look old. But Father would sit in his chair, and he would propose dubia to himself. Theological doubts, theological questions about the abstruse doctrines of the Catholic mysteries, especially the Eucharist. He would pose these questions to himself, and then he would work out the answers step by step, demonstratively, in good scholastic, Thomistic fashion. And then I would come sit down, and he'd put the question to me, right? And he would, you know, drag me through the ringer. And sometimes I would get it right, and sometimes I would get it wrong. And then I would go look it up in St. Thomas and find out that he had always answered the question correctly. That's how, that was his contemplation, right? That's how he spent his time. And when he died, of course, it was surrounded by nuns, by friends, by disciples like myself, by well-wishers, by clergy. And he died, praying the rosary. He expired during the first decade, right, after receiving all of the rites that the church had to offer and all the prayers that we could say for him. And then we immediately had Mass for the repose of his soul minutes later. It was the holiest death. It was the holiest death. I went to see him and I said, Father Lambert, how are you doing? On his deathbed. I'd left my show, actually, went straight to Casa Maria. He had his head in his hand like this. And a man of great understatement, he said, not so good. And he always taught me, you know, to speak about the rule of faith. How do we really know what we know about Christ and the church? The teaching church, that was the doctrine. They always urged me to speak. And I said, Father Lambert, I was on the radio today. I talked about the rule of faith, just like you said. Good. Good. And then he died, right? And he was 101 years old. I believe that he died a virgin. All right? So we talk about love, sex, and death. For me, he will always be an exemplar, an icon of the transcendent value of all of these things that the Catholic faith gives us. the ability to gift our sexuality, either directly to God in consecrated virginity or to another from the transmission of human life. Love as a deep and contemplative engagement with something of value, oriented ultimately towards a death that doesn't mark an abrupt translation between two radically discontinuous states of life, but the final horizon of meaning in light of which all the trivial things that we think we might be doing take on an eternal significance. If you give even a cup of cold water, Jesus says to one of these little ones, because they believe in me, you will not lose your reward. We're called to this contemplative life. And the best, most beautiful summary, I think, that I've read comes from St. Bonaventure in his treatise on the mind's journey into God. And he says, since beatitude is nothing other than the fruition of the Most High Good, and the Most High Good is above us, no one can become blessed unless he ascends above his very self, not by an ascent with the body, but with the heart. For the young, I think the easiest path into the contemplative way is simply through Eucharistic adoration. All right? And now we come to the question, so how do we transmit this to this generation? I think I've identified the need. I think I've identified the solution. What's the delivery mechanism? That one's much harder. You know, I had a call from a young man the other day, and he was about 19 or 20, and he said, you know, none of my friends are interested in religion. None of them are interested in the faith. They're all profoundly interested in me time, right, but not in giving themselves anything of value. How do I persuade them? And, of course, you know, we're up against a difficulty here. One of my own sons said to me a while back, he said, Daddy, you know, you're always right, and nobody cares. How true. How true. Right? How true. How do you win a hearing, even with the most precious thing in the world, if nobody cares? If nobody cares. Jesus had the same problem, right? Jesus had the same problem. All right. Will you two, will you guys leave too? Right? Oh no, Lord, you have the words of eternal life, but most did. How did he handle that problem? Well, we need to know apologetics, of course, but that's not ultimately the answer. Right? How did Christ respond? Well, Christ responded, first of all, by giving himself entirely to a life of contemplative prayer. Go away for hours upon hours upon hours to be with his Father, right? And to live with him, setting us an example. You know, everything in the life of Christ is a model for us on how to live. Every little tiny itty-bitty thing is a model for us on how to live. So we too need to become people of not just of apologetics or of theology or of doctrine or of social activism, but of deep contemplative prayer, to give yourself to something of value, right? And then secondly, Christ healed the sick and cared for the poor. And that speaks; those actions speak louder than words. And so as we ourselves live the contemplative life and live the life of charity and justice, maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to win a hearing from the young people who so desperately need the Catholic tradition and the gift of Catholic contemplation. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of St. Peter the Rock Media and is brought to you by you. If you liked it, consider making a donation and supporting Catholic radio programming on AM 1260 The Rock. Click on the Donate Now button in the upper right corner of the webpage.